As human beings, we hate not knowing. We feel that the more we know, the more we'll be in control of our lives. But recent months have starkly shown us, haven't they, how little we really know. We don't know how to stop the virus. We don't know how to treat it. We don't know how the economy is going to be affected and what that might mean for us. We don't know whether we're going to catch it, and if we do, whether we'll survive. We don't know when other non-COVID medical treatments might happen, which have been delayed. We don't know how schools and workplaces and church services and pubs and sporting events are going to look in the months and even years ahead. And really, all of this is just a microcosm of the bigger issue. For all our human bluster about scientific advances and knowing more and more about the universe, fact is there is so, so much that we do not know and we're not able to know. In Ecclesiastes chapter 11, the big theme is how little we really know. Now, the phrase, "you do not know," appears three times in six short verses. But as usual, Ecclesiastes turns the ways we normally think on their head. Teacher wants to show us how actually there is a real freedom that comes with not knowing. We're going to see that in three parts. Firstly, you don't know the future, so give generously now. You don't know the future, so give generously now. In verses 1 and 2, the issue is you do not know what disaster may come upon the land. In other words, you don't know the future. So how should we deal with that? Fear? Stockpiling? Tightening the purse strings? Cutting our giving because we don't know what we'll be able to afford in the future? In general, be more prudent? Well, the world's wisdom might lead us in that direction. But how does the teacher encourage us to respond to not knowing the future? He says, ship your grain across the sea. After many days, you may receive a return. Invest in seven ventures. Yes, in eight. Now, at first sight, that just sounds like simple pragmatic advice. Invest in many ventures, shrewd business practice. Don't buy shares in just one company because you don't know the future. Maybe that company will have a terrible year and the value of all your shares will plummet. Rather, it's better to spread your assets. Buy some shares here, buy other shares there. And if one business fails, chances are one of your other ones will grow. And in the end, you'll make a profit overall. Well, the world could tell you that, couldn't it? It's fine as worldly wisdom, but I don't think that's what the teacher is really saying. For a start, remember one of the big things in the book of Ecclesiastes that we've been seeing. Life is about gift, not about gain. A teacher has been hammering home to us again and again in different ways that the way to live wisely is not to toil and toil to try and get gain for ourselves, but rather to be content and to enjoy the good gifts that God gives us today. Gift, not gain. But also the teacher, his choice of words points us in another direction. Verse 1, ship your grain, is more literally translated in the ESV, cast your grain. And verse 2, invest in seven ventures, is more literally give a portion to seven. And together those verbs have the sense of hold lightly to things, give things away. More than that, the sense is give very generously. Verse 1, across the sea. Cast it far and wide. Don't just ship things to Stoke-on-Trent, ship them to India and Venezuela and Siberia and the Yemen. Maybe you'll get a return, but even if you do, that may be well off into the future. Verse 2, give a portion of seven, or to seven, or even eight. How would people in the Bible times describe the most extremely generous giver? Probably by using the number seven, Bible's number for completeness and perfection. A very generous person would be someone who gives to seven different good causes. But what the teacher does here, it encourages us to do what? Give to seven or even eight. In other words, give abundantly, give sacrificially, give generously, and then give some more on top of that. Do you see? It is the exact opposite of the world's logic. The world says, you don't know the future, so protect your savings. Batten down the hatches. But the teacher says, you don't know the future, so give with generous abandon. Now, that doesn't mean that we should be giving money that we don't have. There is an important place for prudence, wisely stewarding the resources God has given us. But the teacher's challenge is, at some point, we may lose all our treasured possessions. So the best way to prepare for that is to hold lightly to those things by giving them away. And what Jesus says about the hoarder, the man who built so many barns with so much grain that he didn't know what to do with it. And he thought to himself that all his shrewd business skills and his careful investments had secured a great future for him. Now he could sit back and he could enjoy the fruit of all those labours. But there was something he didn't know. He didn't know that very day he was going to die. And how much better it would have been for him if he had given all his surplus grain away to others. You can imagine, as he lay dying, he would have then had the comfort of knowing that there were seven or eight others whose lives had been much better because of his generosity. The fact that he didn't know the future should have led him not to be more miserly, but more generous. As Jesus says, why store up treasures on earth which can so easily be lost? Instead, store up treasures in heaven, treasures which can never be lost. Jesus urges us not to trust in money, but to trust our Heavenly Father to provide the things that we need. You and I don't know the future, but He does. You and I have a limited viewpoint, but He sees it all. Hasn't He proven His trustworthiness so clearly? Hasn't He proved it by His own generous giving? Hasn't He proved it by giving us the most costly and generous gift He could ever give, the gift of His Son? Hasn't Jesus proved it by using His life to lay down all His gain and instead give everything He had, even give His own life, to bring us back to God? We don't need to know the future. Our Father has it perfectly in His hands. We don't need to know what will happen tomorrow. But if today we have more than we need, then we can give generously. Not knowing the future frees us from putting our confidence in our pragmatic plans. It frees us instead to use what we have now to generously bless others. So how could you use your money to bless seven or even eight? How could you use your skills, not just for your own benefit, but to bless seven or even eight? How could you use your time today, tomorrow, not just to spend it doing things that make you feel comfortable, but to bless 7 or even 8. You don't know how long you'll have all these things, that cash, those skills, that time. Your life, Ecclesiastes has made very clear, is a mere vapour. It's here today and it's gone tomorrow. But you can use those things today to bless other people. So take advantage of that freedom. You don't know the future, so generously give now. Then secondly, you don't know the way God works, so get on with life now. You don't know the way God works, so get on with life now. Verse 3. If clouds are full of water, they pour rain on the earth. Whether a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where it falls, there it will lie. Well, taking the example of the weather, there are some things, of course, that we do know. But unlike God, our knowledge is limited. There was that famous time in 1987 when a hurricane was forecast for the southeast of England. And the night before, the BBC weather forecaster Michael Fish reassured the public that it was not going to be that serious. But he got it completely wrong. In the morning, people woke up to find that it had wreaked absolute havoc and that several people had tragically lost their lives. Of course, that was an unusual example. But even when we know that rain is coming, we don't know how bad that rain will be. We don't know whether there might be flooding. And if there is flooding, we don't know how big an impact it'll have. And then the other example the teacher gives us is about a tree that falls to the ground. And we might study the path of the wind, but when the hurricane comes, we can't know whether the tree will fall this way or that way. When people got into their cars that morning in 1987 to try to drive to work, they turned a corner not knowing whether there might be a fallen tree blocking the way. Verse 5 summarises the point. As you do not know the path of the wind, or how the body is formed in the mother's womb, so you cannot understand, or you do not know, the work of God, the maker of all things. We don't know the path of the wind. We don't know how a baby is formed, even with all our modern scientific knowledge. Do we really know how the cells divide at exactly the right time so that an eye begins to form? Or a finger begins to grow? And the teacher tells us it is like that with all of God's works. Job makes a very similar point in Job chapter 38. Well, God speaking to Job. And God says, Job, have you ever given orders to the morning or shown the dawn its place? What is the way to the abode of light? And where does darkness reside? Can you take them to their places? Do you know the paths to their dwellings? Do you send out lightning bolts on their way? Do they report to you, here we are? Point is, how can we fathom all the things that God has done? How can we fathom the colours of the sunset that are different every day? How can we fathom the beauty of birdsong? How can we fathom the casting into space of billions of stars? This last week we got Timothy's new telescope out again and we saw not only Jupiter but two of its moons and also the planet Saturn. And I was looking up on the web and Saturn apparently is nearly a billion miles away. We can't get our heads around those kind of numbers, can we? But Saturn is really, really close to us compared to the rest of the universe. And God knows and sees and creates and sustains every single atom of it. But again, teacher wants us to see that our lack of knowledge is actually a freeing thing. Verse 4. Whoever watches the wind will not plant. Whoever looks at the clouds will not reap. See, there are two ways that we can respond to not knowing these things. One way is inaction. We can watch the wind and the skies to try to get godlike knowledge that will make life somehow better for us. We can put our effort into trying to find out some things that only God knows the answer to try to get more gain for ourselves. Or we can accept that there are things that we're not meant to know. Accept that there are things that it's right for only God to know. And therefore stop fretting about those things. And if we do that, it sets us free to get on with life now. To embrace the things that we do see. The things that God has made known to us. In verse 4 terms, to get on with the planting and the reaping. Get on with the things that God has given us today. Again, I think the current crisis is a helpful example of this point. Of course, it is good for our scientists to search for a vaccine and for a cure. God has given them the gifts and skills so they can get on and do those things. But for the rest of us, we don't know what God's doing in all this situation. We can't fathom what his plans might be. His ways are far above our ways. And if we accept that, it sets us free from scratching our heads and trying to explain everything. It sets us free to embrace the opportunities that we can see, that God has given us today. It sets us free to get on with our lives today, whatever today might look like. And all the more so when we do know the greatest work that God has done, because he has made that known to us. We do know that God gave his son Jesus on the cross to pay the penalty for our sin. We do know that if we are relying on Jesus' death, then our sins are completely forgiven. We do know that because of Jesus, we are heading to heaven. We know those things because God has told us. And therefore we can leave to God the things that we don't know and throw ourselves wholeheartedly into the life that he's given us today. Well, then finally, in verse 6, you don't know what will succeed, so live a full life now. You don't know what will succeed, so live a full life now. Sow your seed in the morning, and at the evening let your hand not be idle, for you do not know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both will do equally well. Now here I think the teacher touches on something that really bothers us. It bothers us because so much of the time we make an idol out of success. And we see that, to give one example, in the culture of education. About 20 years ago, when I was thinking about becoming a teacher, I read a book by the journalist Melanie Phillips called All Must Have Prizes. And she looks at the philosophy of education, which says that school children must all be rewarded. Everything should be celebrated. Even if actually the child could have done a lot better if they'd put their mind to it a little bit harder. And she poses the question, if we teach our children that they've never failed at anything, how are they going to cope when they become adults? And inevitably, at some point, they fail. And of course, the issue doesn't stop, does it, with childhood? As adults, we find it very difficult to cope with the concept that we might fail at something. I remember feeling that as a new experience for me, really, when I was a newly qualified teacher, doing my first year as a teacher. Up till that point, I'd really always succeeded at things, GCSEs, A-levels, going to Oxford. And now there I was in the classroom, really struggling with some of the classes I was teaching, really struggling to control some of the behaviour, and particularly struggling to come to terms with the fact that it was possible I might not pass my NQT year. And I found that really challenging because over the years I'd built up this self-identity for myself that I was someone who succeeds. But the reality is, we won't always be successful. We may have ambitions for the future. We may put our heart and our soul into achieving them. But we may end up finding that the people who told us that we can achieve anything if we work hard enough, actually they were selling us a lie. The teacher, once again, learned that lesson 3,000 years before we did. You do not know which will succeed. If you pour everything into your career, maybe you'll succeed, or maybe you won't. You simply don't know. If you're really good at sports and you put everything into making a success out of that, maybe you will succeed. Or maybe you'll get an injury that ends your career just when it was on the upward curve. Or if you pin everything on being a successful parent, maybe your children will grow up to be godly, loving, successful adults. Or maybe they won't. You just don't know which will succeed and which won't. So how do we deal with that? Does it lead us to just give up trying? Or does it lead us to settle for mediocrity? Or does it lead us as a church to stick with the things that we're safe with? And not to try any new ideas for sharing the good news of Jesus, because we're paralysed by that fear that we might fail. Well, once again, the teacher takes exactly the opposite view. He encourages us to accept the reality that sometimes we will fail, and therefore to live a full life now, throwing our energy into lots of different things. Verse 6. Sow your seed in the morning, maybe that'll prove successful. But don't stop there, don't put your feet up. Rather, get up again in the evening and work hard at another thing. Why? Because you don't know which will succeed, the one or the other, or maybe both. As we often say, don't put all your eggs in one basket. Don't make your life all about work, or all about sports, or all about making sure that your children grow up to be model adults. Rather, accept that you don't know whether each one of those things will succeed or not. And so give appropriate time to each of them. Now again, that can be a really freeing thing. See, if our sense of self-worth is based on being successful, it's likely to lead us to feeling pressured and stressed, and if we don't succeed, feeling crushed and broken. But if we accept that we simply don't know what will succeed, it can set us free from that fear of failure. It could set us free to live a full life now, seeing the different things we do as gifts from God, rather than as means to get gain for ourselves. Trusting God with the outcome and knowing that failure, if it happens, is not the worst thing that could happen to us. So I hope you can see it is a very good thing that God is God and we are not. You and I don't know the future. We don't know how God works. We don't know what will succeed. And rather than that being a burden, accepting that only God knows those things can be liberating. It can set us free to be generous givers. It can set us free to live life today. It can set us free to live a full life, rather than one that's paralysed by the fear of failure. So will you let go of that chain of trying to control your life? That chain of running after gain. Will you instead trust your Heavenly Father and live in the joyful freedom that He has given you today?